Translation, O fools, just read Chaitanya Mangal. By reading this book, you can understand all the glories of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Purport. Sri Vrindavan Das Thakur's Chaitanya Bhagavata was originally entitled Chaitanya Mangal, or Mangala, but when Sri Lochan Das Thakur later wrote another book named Chaitanya Mangala, Sri Vrindavan Das Thakur changed the name of his own book, which is now therefore known as Chaitanya Bhagavata. The life of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is very elaborately described in Chaitanya Bhagavata, and Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami has already informed us that in his Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, he has described whatever Vrindavan Das Thakur has not mentioned. This acceptance of Sri Chaitanya Bhagavata by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami indicates his acceptance of the disciplic succession. A writer of transcendental literature never tries to surpass the previous acharyas. While we may go ahead on this, there are many statements here that are worth focusing on. A writer of transcendental literature never tries to surpass the previous acharyas. This is a kind of paradoxical statement, because it's not a question of surpassing previous authors or acharyas or teachers on the one hand, and on the other hand, you're supposed to progress forward. So it can appear to be something that surpasses on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's really not surpassing so much, but it is a continuation, something to be continued, something to be further elaborated upon. And we have that marvelous metaphor in the Bhagavat of Shuka, the narrator of the Bhagavat, to Maharaj Parikshit, of the mango. The narrator, of course, is called Parrot. Okay, Shuka means parrot. And the idea here is that when the parrot slices into the mango with its beak, the mango becomes all the sweeter. Now, I have to personally confess to all of you that, you know, when in India, I've never really opted for the mango that has been sliced by the beak of a shuka. Okay? But when I've seen that, I've always meditated on this idea of it being sweeter. So, in the same way a writer of transcendental literature is looking to build on what has been so beautifully put forward by the parampara, the writer in the Vaishnava parampara is trying to show increasing ways of appreciating and delving into the transcendental subject matter. So this is not surpassing. I think what is meant here, the idea of surpassing previous acharyas, is somehow to in many ways maybe cancel them out, maybe make them irrelevant. And that is never the goal of a transcendental author. In fact, the transcendental author tries to make what has been written in the past relevant to what we are doing now in the present, at the present time. Why? Well, for one thing, language changes. Language changes. Even in my short, or compared to some of you, extremely long lifetime, back when I was a teenager, the word gay meant happy. And, you know, upon being greeted this morning by Shruti Dharmaji, he said, "How are you?" And I could have said, "I'm feeling rather gay." And, you know, I'm sure, I mean, he's such a generous Vaishnava, I'm sure he would have looked at me and said, "Good. that's nice. But he would have been thinking, okay, somehow Garuda's coming out of the closet or something like that. Okay? But you see, the word now has taken on other meanings. One has to be very careful in the choice of words. Words are very, very powerful, and they're very potent. All that you have to do is utter a certain four-letter word on a plane, and the whole plane stops. It won't fly. The word bomb. All you have to do is say that once on an airplane, and the plane goes absolutely nowhere. Language is potent, especially when an author uses words very, very carefully and brings into engagement powerful ideas. So this becomes the efficacious tool of a presenter of Krishna Bhakti. So transcendental literature never tries, the writer of transcendental literature never tries to surpass. But yet we are trying to update language, update the presentation of ideas, so people at the present time can receive it and absorb it very easily. And it depends on the audience, the adjustment of language to a particular audience. So when I was writing my Harvard dissertation, I mean, the professors at Harvard, they expect a certain kind of erudition that is, by the way, Harvard is a school in the U.S. You may not have heard of it, but I have to realize I'm in a foreign land here. So it's a fairly known school over in the U.S. So writing for a dissertation, for example, it requires a certain high level of erudition. You're expected to show professors that you're able to utilize language in a very technical fashion. And so some of you may have remembered when I was here talking about Tamal Krishna Goswami's book that I completed, that those five chapters that he wrote and left us, which was a little bit raw, and I edited them with the help of some other people as well. When I would go around talking about Goswami's book, I would always tell devotees that the five chapters that you're going to encounter here are frankly going to be not intelligible by most of you, because it was written for his professors at Cambridge. And that's why I made my first introduction and my last concluding chapter much more readable. So at least you have something to read when you read the book. One time I gave a talk, it was in the States, on Goswami's book, and I said, if you're suffering from insomnolence, this is a great book to read, because you will surely fall asleep when reading it, because it is highly technical. So it's not meant for a wide audience. And also the publisher I got to publish the book, Oxford University Press, New York, is used to publishing books that are for a more rarefied audience, a more technical, more technically inclined audience. So this is another way that transcendental literature may be focused. Again, not surpassing, but making more accessible and making current. So we have to make that sort of observation clear. You noticed in this purport, Prabhupada is teaching us how when you write something, you don't want to write something that is repetitive of what someone else has done. So Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami has told his reader that Vrindavanas Thakur, he is taking care of other things, especially the earlier life of Mahaprabhu. So I'm not going to cover that. I'm going to cover the later portions of Mahaprabhu's life. So he's careful to fit in. His contribution is something that is to complement and be compatible with what has already been done. So again, this is another way to not be surpassing, but to be, in some sense, contributing. And I would make a distinction between what is surpassing and what is really a genuine contribution. So even in the institutions of higher learning that we have today in the West, you're told when you get a doctorate that you are to make an original contribution to knowledge. Okay, they always give you that sort of scary assignment. You are to make an original contribution to knowledge, and they tell you that your dissertation or your thesis, your doctoral thesis, can't be any more than 300 pages. Now, of course, I'm thinking in my head, 300 pages. How am I going to write 300 pages? It's not just quantity for quantity's sake, but the quantity is supposed to indicate something of the depth, pursuit of the subject matter. So in my mind at the time, of course, I remember thinking, well, a graduate paper that you write for a course is around 20 to 30 pages. So a dissertation could be like sewing together 9 of these papers. You know, I tried to make it like doable for myself. It was a little daunting and scary at the time, so long ago when I did this. But then in writing the dissertation, I actually had to apply to the Committee on Advanced Degrees to allow me to go longer than 300 pages. So what happened? My original intention was to write about Krishnadas Kaviraj in comparison to some other mystical thinkers in the Christian tradition. That was always my intention, to do a comparative study and place Krishna Bhakti that Prabhupada is so generously given to us, to place it in dialogue with other traditions, in a real, a deeper dialogue with other traditions. That was my intention for so long. So when I went to my doctoral mentor, he said, so to do this comparison, he said, I'm completely confident that there's plenty of work done, scholarly work done on the Christian side. I'm not so confident that there's enough done on the Vaishnava side. And this scholar, by the way, was a very fine scholar. He was, I used to rate scholars according to the gunas. You know, some scholars are tamasika, you know, some are rajasic, and some are sattvika. And the sattvika scholars were the ones, of course, from whom I could really learn quite a bit. And he certainly was a sattvika scholar. And so I would bring things back to his office about every few weeks to try to evolve a dissertation concept that would pass a committee of 33 professors from around the whole Harvard community, which is a little unusual there. Usually it's just 3 or 4 professors that look over a dissertation proposal, but where I went, it was a committee. Religion was a committee. Committees are very dangerous in the academic setting. It's better to deal with smaller groups. But so one day he talked to me and he said, let me ask you this. For the Chaitanya Vaishnava tradition, what is its very highest vision? I mean, here's my professor asking me, what is the very highest vision of the Chaitanya school? Now, you know, here, suddenly I'm being confronted with this question. I'm supposed to tell this very famous scholar, what is our tradition ultimately about? He said, you can take a minute, which I was happy that he gave me that minute. So I'm sitting back, and of course I'm flipping through the Bhagavad Gita like rapid speed, right? And then I'm flipping through the Bhagavata, and then I'm flipping through the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the 3 primary texts that Prabhupada gave us. And I'm sitting back and I'm thinking, okay, let me just think about how to put all this together. And then I'm thinking about the Chaitanya Charitamrita and how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ultimately is focusing on the Bhagavata. So here is a text that in some sense moves us back into the Bhagavata with a special lens. With a special lens. The lens of a prema netra. with the eye of pure love. Prema netra. So he's focusing back on the Bhagavata, and what does Mahaprabhu himself delight in the most? The Bhagavata's Raslila. So I then opened up to my professor and I said, well, it would have to be the Raslila. I mean, that would have to be the ultimate statement of the tradition. Because even in the later theological developments of the tradition, Mahaprabhu is just endlessly delighting in that and the literatures that expound upon it. He said, okay, has there been scholarly treatment of that? And I said, there must be, because, I mean, people talk about it. Colleagues, scholars talk about it all the time. He said, show me. So a month I scoured the Harvard libraries, and I came back empty-handed. No one has treated the Raslila. He said, that is your dissertation. And I'm thinking, the Raslila. Then I'm thinking of all my God brothers and God sisters. Guess what I'm writing about? The Raslila. Now, back in the, late 80s and early 90s, to be writing about the Raslila, it's still a subject matter that needs a lot of respect, and it can be so greatly misunderstood. In fact, when reading ahead here, which maybe we should do, if the time permits, Prabhupada says here, he's very concerned about the way that the Bhagavata is presented. He says, few men can understand its purpose. The original commentary is the Vedanta Sutra. So, how do we align the Bhagavata and the understanding of the Bhagavata with the Vedanta Sutra? On the one hand, and then on the other hand, how do we understand the Bhagavata as aligned with the Chaitanya Charitamrita? So, these are complex questions. He talks about the professional writers, reciters, creating the impression that the Bhagavatam deals only with Krishna's Raslila. Okay? And Prabhupada very bluntly says, they have in this way presented Krishna to the Western world as a great woman hunter. And therefore we sometimes have to deal with such misconceptions. So that is ultimately what I tried to do. It didn't seem that there was any wiggle room getting out of this rather lofty assignment, writing your dissertation on the Raslila. So how to present the Raslila in such a way that persons in the Western world who were not part of the tradition could appreciate it and understand it, at least on some respectable levels. Well, one thing I found was that my Sanskrit teacher pointed out that the Dashama Skanda, the 10th book, and especially the Raslila chapters, he said was the most enchanting poem ever written. Now that is high praise coming from someone who has nothing to do with the tradition personally, but looks at the Bhagavata as great literature. So amazing. The most enchanting. First of all, academics don't make superlative or absolute statements like that. We're always relativizing everything. That's what squalors do. Scholars, I meant to say. Yeah. That's what scholars do. They relativize things. Yeah, this is good, that's better, that's good, but nothing is best. But here he is saying the Dashama Skanda, the 10th book of the Bhagavata, is the most enchanting poem ever written. Now, this is a man who used to read poetry, he's no longer alive, who read poetry in at least a dozen languages. If I tell you it's the most enchanting poem ever written, you all say to me, yeah, Garuda, yeah, of course. We all say that. Nothing new in that. Nothing tremendous in that. But someone who's outside the tradition, looking at it in comparison to Persian poetry, Hebrew poetry, Arabic poetry, Tamil poetry. In all these languages, he comes up with the most enchanting poem ever written. Now that is high praise. So one of the things that I ended up doing in my dissertation was to find out just exactly why it was such exquisite literature. So just on a literary level, the Bhagavata presents this jewel of poetry and literature. And then, of course, you know, one is tasked with the idea that that what the Rasleela can appear to be doing to an uninformed reader needs to be elaborated and interpreted for their eyes, needs to be presented that way. So later I found out, after finishing the dissertation and completing the dissertation, and as it was so amazingly and fortunately published by really one of the very finest presses, academic presses in the world, Princeton University Press, I later found out that there was another colleague of mine at the same time writing on the Rasleela at another university. And she was writing about it from a women's studies perspective, but something of an extreme one. She was looking at it as a very misogynistic text, which is what Prabhupada, the very thing Prabhupada was concerned about. The interesting thing is that she's a very nice lady, but she has never gotten her book published. No one seems to want to publish her interpretation of the Rasleela. Partly because, well, there's always, you know, Schweig's. Dr. Schweig has already done his, so no need for yours. And one day I received an invitation to review an article for a very prestigious journal, and it was on how the Rasleela passage is really a kind of surreptitious intention on the Brahmins of the Bhagavata, the Brahmin writers of the Bhagavata, to keep women in a subjugated position in relation to men. And what you may not know is that these are double-blind reviews. And what double-blind review means, and again, this is the modern way that literature that is proposed for publication is vetted to see if it's worthy of publication. It goes through a rigorous process of peer review. Just as Krishnadas Kaviraj sought peer review, just as I got these enthusiastic exhortations from a devotee who's now no longer with us here. Oh, there he is. Oh, very good. Okay, yes. Okay, good. Yeah, I missed him. Yes, there. Yeah, there's orange hat right over there. So we look for approval, we seek approval, and some level of consensus. And so also it's, with Krishnadas Kaviraj, he got the permission. He sought permission. I think this chapter is also about, right, seeking authorization. So he sought it from the devotees. He sought it from the deity. He wanted assurance that this is the right thing for me to be doing. So this lady, this scholar, couldn't get her book published, but she tried to get an article published. And so they said, well, this is on the Rasleela. Graham Schweig is the world's authority on the Rasleela. They said, we'll send it to him. So I'm not supposed to know that it is she that is the author, right? It's double blind. So she's not supposed to know that I'm reviewing it, and I'm not supposed to know who wrote the article, to be as objective as possible. But clever me knew it was she. So, and I ended up rejecting the article, not because of what we call a deconstructionist interpretation, where she's looking at it critically, looking at it how it can be interpreted from a feminist perspective, because I actually like a lot of feminist thinking that's out there. But it was a treatment that was so poorly substantiated, her criticisms of the Bhagavata were just unfounded. And clearly she was bringing some personal agenda into her scholarship. And that's not really good scholarship. So I reviewed it very carefully. By the way, it's always much harder to write a critique of something that is to be rejected than it is to write a critique of something that is accepted. Because you have to also counter the statements made there. So your statements as in a critique have to be far more weighty and powerful to reject it. Anyway, the end of the story is that I did reject it, and I gave a very elaborate critique of it, and they never published it, which is good, because it really was not representing. Again, I don't mind, in the spirit of academics and intellectual thought, looking at things from various angles of vision. That's very, very useful. That's very useful, and it's very scholarly to do that, to consider all the ways something can be seen. Prabhupada himself is considering here the way that the Bhagavata Rasa-lila can be seen as a story of a great woman hunter. Okay? But, you know, all scriptures have strange things that require, you know, a supervision for interpretation. I mean, look at the New Testament. I mean, Jai. I always remember this this beautiful altar. When I came here a year after the manor was purchased, I think it was in 1974. Right? Was that right? Is it 73? It was, right? So I was here in 74. I remember coming here, and we only had, of course, Radha and Krishna here, and there were no curtains up. So the whole, it was a sort of a greenhouse, or what do you call it, a sunroom type thing? Conservatory. A conservatory. Yes. Yes. Yes, Naveen Krishna is teaching me a lot of your British ways and how to structure my language. Structure. Do you like that? I've been practicing all night. But yes, in the conservatory, there were no curtains, and it was so light, and the light was... And I remember the Pujari then, and I don't remember his name... but let me go right on the altar taking pictures. So I brought home pictures of this beautiful altar. And I love the way the light comes in. It's a very special altar. There are not many altars that are established in, let me try it, conservatories. Right, okay, good. So anyway, sorry for the distraction, but it's a little hard not to be distracted. So, in writing transcendental literature, Prabhupada tells us, desha kalapatra, right? Time, place, and circumstance. One needs to be aware of one's audience. In the case of my rejection of this article, this is an audience that expected the highest level of scholarship, and arguments, whatever they would be, needed to be substantiated. And this was too much a projection of her personal struggle as a woman, perhaps who had been in abusive situations. And for that, I was extremely sympathetic. And I said, maybe this needs to be published more in a kind of feminist magazine or something like that. But not here. Not here. This does not contribute to any critique, any scholarly critique that would be valid, or a constructive presentation of the text. So I came to understand a little bit why Krishna sort of forced me into writing on the Rasa-lila. You know, he sort of made me unwittingly this sort of the guard of the Rasa-lila, you know, the protector of it from misguided academic interpretations. So, you know, in ISKCON, you know, we have, if you haven't already noticed, hundreds of books available now. Hundreds of books. Endless things are being published. And these days, publishing is easy. It's so easy. But still, to get something published by a very prestigious press is extremely hard and rigorous, because it does go through a tremendous amount of peer review. And it's a little bit of a club. I mean, it's good to have a PhD from a place like Harvard. That's a school in the U.S. I don't really trust any of you to know what that place is. Okay, it's like your Cambridge. Okay, your Cambridge or Oxford, something like that. Okay, and it's so one has to have the qualifications on the one hand, but also one has to the content of the work has to carry itself. Now, in our devotional context, Prabhupada, it's so interesting what Prabhupada did. When Prabhupada came, I mean, he came when he was about 70 years old. Now, I'm 10 years younger than that, and I cannot even imagine how he was traveling around the world 12 times, creating a whole worldwide movement, dealing with us. How many of you were there back in the day? How many? Let me see hands. Or around when Prabhupada was around? None. Okay. Very good. One. Okay. Excellent. Okay. So I have the company of one from way back then. When Prabhupada was around, he was it's amazing. He sort of injected the movement with a certain literature right away. So he wanted to make sure, before he had really written most of the Bhagavata commentary, he gave us the Krishna book very early on, right? He also gave us the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, known back then as TLC, you know, which was a revision of what it originally meant in the West, tender loving care, right? So TLC now became Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, right? He gave us Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, and he gave us a shortened version of the Bhagavad Gita. So he gave us the quick versions of everything right away. He wanted to make sure he was around to give us the very essence, right? And really, these three pieces of literature, and of course later we know, he gave us the more elaborate version of the Bhagavad Gita. He gave us, you know, almost the whole Bhagavata, up to the beginning parts of the Dashama Skanda, and some of our god brothers finished continued the Bhagavata, and he gave us the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita. These three texts, of course, he gave us other things too, and of course, maybe the most significant one after these three would be the Nectar of Devotion or the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. But really, these three, the Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavata and the Chaitanya Charitamrita, are what we might call, and what I've written about, as the Prasthana Trayi, the three foundational texts. So whether we have hundreds of other books around or not, the fact is, these three, whether you're finding good translations, mediocre translations, or even poor and inadequate translations of other kinds of literature, from the Vaishnava lineage, and surely there is much there. These three, we need to remember not to be distracted from these three. Everything is in these three. It really is. I mean, I have read, for my book, I had gone into the commentaries of the Goswamis for the understanding of the Raslila. And when that book came out, by the way, in 2005, I came here and presented on it. I don't know if any of you were here back then, but Dance of Divine Love was the book and is still the book. And I read, you know, deep into the acharyas and what they had to say about that text. And back then there were no even bad or good translations of those commentaries, of those bhashyas. And I had to read it in a text that had Bengali characters for the Sanskrit. So it was a kind of, you know, extra strenuous sort of exercise to go into the commentaries. And what I found there is maybe I experienced a little bit of what Prabhupada had to do, is how to bring out and to choose things that would make sense. Because you couldn't bring everything in. I mean, there are loads of commentaries. If Prabhupada had translated all the commentaries to the different Bhagavata verses throughout the Bhagavata, it would be probably as from that, you know, wall behind Prabhupada to behind the deities in the conservatory. I mean, it really would be just unbelievably long. I mean, the Vaishnava literature that has been produced is tremendous. But the idea is to bring these things into engagement in current times. And I think it is a matter of sort of cherry-picking the things that would be most valuable. And that's what Prabhupada does. He brings in things that were said before and then brings and frames it with his own vision. And so here Prabhupada is warning us about the reciters of the Bhagavata. He's warning us about the various speculative presentations or the negative interpretations, the bad interpretations. So that is one of the things that a Vaishnava writer does, is he or she must protect those literatures and bring and engage those literatures in very respectful ways and bring them forward. And this is another way that one does not surpass what previous acharyas do, but rather respects them, because those things are brought into engagement for this modern audience. If this is done well, it's like putting like jewels into a new setting with added jewels. And that can be quite beautiful when it comes to jewelry, right? So in the same way with literature, we bring these jewels that are especially luminous for us in the present day into the foreground and bring those into contemporary discussion. So that is the value of writing. I think as devotees, we need to hesitate when we think about writing something. Is this really something that will be useful? Is it something that would really be necessary? I know that many of my God brothers, actually some God sisters in the past too, have consulted with me on their writing projects. Currently, there are several people, several devotees consulting with me on their projects and wanting to get feedback and advice and so on. And so that's a natural part of the process, to get peer review, peer reaction, so as to make something relevant and something very valuable. On the other hand, it's sometimes the case that we should intentionally not write on something. And one of the things that I've been struggling with, and I go back and forth on, is whether or not we should present certain literature that is already out there, that is misrepresented, but that may be considered too confidential, as we say, right? Too much of an intimate literature to write on. And one of those texts, one of the you know, Mahaprabhu had five particular works about which he was extremely fond and would have these things recited and so forth. And one of them was the Gita Govinda of Jayadev. The Gita Govinda. And in the Gita Govinda, this is the main place where Srimati Radharani is presented. This is where we get the most powerful presentation of Srimati Radharani. And I have it that when a devotee presented to Prabhupada, I believe it was in Mumbai, in the Juhu Temple, in his quarters, I think it was possibly, I forgot who the devotee was. I don't think it was Giriraj Swami, but in any case, Prabhupada had a translation of the Gita Govinda in his hands, and he was reading some of it to the devotee and said, we cannot present. How can we present this? You know, he was, at that time, he was concerned that we would be sort of throwing pearls before swine, so to speak, that the general public would just in no way be able to not misinterpret this text. And I think at the time, his approach was just better to leave it alone, just not even bring it into the foreground from us, and let whatever happens on the outside happen. So this has been very a great conflict to me, because a lot of my academic colleagues go to this Gita Govinda in translation, and the translation is just not good. And yet they consider it to be very good. So then I want to jump in and say, look, you know, let's do a translation of this. Let's correct it. Let's give our vision of it. Let the tradition reclaim such a valuable text. But then again, I have this sort of haunting, you know, story of Prabhupada saying, we cannot do. So I'm just talking with all of you about my problems. Is that all right? First, you'll forgive me that I'm American, right? I mean, we can put that behind us, right? Okay, good. So this is really a conflict. How to present such a valuable text to our tradition, and something that Mahaprabhu himself treasured unlimitedly. And yet, we've been sort of cautioned greatly by Prabhupada. So I can't ignore what my teacher, you know, what my guru has said. Not that that was the be-all and end-all of the discussion, but I would need to be absolutely assured that it was the right thing to do. And at this point, I'm not. So, you know, this is something that I've been looking at over the years. And every time there's a discussion on the Gita Govinda, I jump in and try to correct things, you know, and try to have things seen from the Vaishnava point of view. And in fact, the very first verse of the Gita Govinda, I wrote about it and translated it, correcting a well-known translation of the Gita Govinda. And it is a beautiful, beautiful text. First verses of Sanskrit literature are extremely important. We know from the Bhagavatam, the first verse is very powerful, right? It presents, you know, so much. I mean, it's a very rich first verse. And the first verse of the Raslila is also very, very powerful as an independent five-chapter lila that is, in a way, can be read even unto itself. It's almost like a drama unto itself. I discuss these things in the book that I wrote. So first verses, say even the Bhagavad Gita, Dharma Kshetre Kurukshetre Samaveta Yoyotsavaha Mamaka Padavaschaiva Kima Kurvata Sanjaya. So in that text, I have talked about how Kima Kurvata, the question, the interrogative, is an extremely important line. You know, how did they act, O Sanjaya? Kima kuravata Sanjaya? Because I explained to my reader that the whole Gita is about how do we act in a world of conflict, pain, and suffering? How do we act? How should we act? So this was a book that I did, right? I did a translation of Bhagavad Gita. Many of you know of this. And so one time I gave a lecture at the Potomac Temple in Washington, D.C. area. And there was a devotee during the Sunday feast lecture who got up and challenged me. He said, why have you done a translation of Bhagavad Gita when your spiritual master, you think you can surpass your spiritual master? Right? He was very challenging, right? And I was thinking, okay, this is a Sunday feast lecture. So I want to be considerate of others here. And I said, your questions are very good. They're very valid. Your challenge is very valid. And in fact, you could even say this about other things I've written. Who are you to write about the Ras Lila? You know, Garuda Das. You know, who are you? You know, what sort of devotee just jumps to the Ras Lila, right? I've had that challenge, right? And then I get, who are you to write or offer a translation of the Bhagavad Gita when our spiritual master, or when you're, they always say your spiritual master, right? They really dig it in, right? When your spiritual master has already presented the be-all and end-all Bhagavad Gita. Now, of course, you know what we all do, right? We go to Prabhupada's unlimited number of statements, right? And you can find things there that can pretty much support almost anything reasonable that, you know, your reasonable point of view can be supported by Prabhupada somewhere in his letters, his discussions, right? So, you know, and we use Prabhupada to sort of authorize ourselves, you know? And sometimes that feels sort of, I mean, I know this is our habit, but sometimes that feels kind of cheap. Like, why can't I support it on my own? If it's really something worthy, I should be able to appeal to your sense of rationality and your own sense of understanding as a devotee. But there I was, appealing to a conversation. You know, I brought out a conversation to this devotee in the Sunday feast lecture. I said that Prabhupada was asked, what will you translate next, Prabhupada? And this was related by Pradyumna. And there were several devotees around, and I think Radhavallabha was asking this question to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, there's so many works. There's the Mahabharata, there's the Ramayana, there's this, there's that. And he said, casually, and there's the Bhagavad Gita. And devotees kind of looked around. Like, well, Prabhupada, haven't you already translated the Bhagavad Gita? Yeah. In other words, when Prabhupada used to say things that seemed to be contrary to fact or reality, we all just assumed that we didn't know what. I mean, so Prabhupada said we can translate Bhagavad Gita. Obviously, Bhagavad Gita never was translated by Prabhupada suddenly. You know, but someone at least had the guts to ask Prabhupada, well, don't we have your Bhagavad Gita? And Prabhupada said, well, of course, but there are so many Gitas. We can also make more. We can write more. So, of course, this lets me off the hook really easily, right? I just bring in Prabhupada. You know, I said, but even if Prabhupada had not said that, I have my reasons. And I can give them to you if you'd be so open to them. You know, and so we talked about it. There was a discussion. So, again, the idea of, you know, authorized literature or bona fide, we use that sort of outdated Latin expression, right? Bona fide, right? Good faith, it means literally good faith, in good faith. Right, but we have there's an extra sense to it when we use it. Bona fide means, you know, absolutely authorized, right? But interesting that the literal meaning of it, in good faith, a sense that something valuable is here. Let me find out more about it. Let me enter into more of what's going on here. At one time, the Potomac Temple was selling my Bhagavad Gita alongside with Prabhupada's Gita. So it was brought to my attention that someone had taken one of those books of mine and written in it as if I were writing. I'm assuming it's a he. He was plagiarizing me, and he wrote in it where you would put the inscription on the flip side of the front cover. I wrote this Bhagavad Gita because I know better than my spiritual master, Garuda Das. So, you know, there are different ways I thought about this. One is that, okay, so at a sort of external level, I'm thinking, well, this is a destruction of property. First of all, someone bought this Gita and then took it home and found my little note, right? And was rather appalled by it and brought it to the attention of Anuttamaji. And then I said, can you take a picture of it with your phone, send it to me? I really want to see this, you know. And of course, the writing is nothing like mine, so I can assure you we can do any tests that way. But the idea is that on an external level, you know, this was obviously aggressive and sort of a cowardly act, because instead of just coming to me and saying, Garuda, why have you done this? Why have you surpassed? Why have you tried to surpass? You haven't, you obnoxious Vaishnava, you. You haven't surpassed Prabhupada, but I see that you've tried to. Or I'm worried that you've tried to. Why not a heart-to-heart discussion? This is the best way. And Rupa Goswami says, one who's attaining to bhava is straightforward in ordinary dealings. So this was not a straightforward way of criticizing my publication of the Bhagavad Gita translation. So on the one hand, this was a cowardly act. It was an act out of fear that somehow Garuda was doing something that would be somehow eclipsing Prabhupada instead of perhaps enhancing what Prabhupada was giving us. On a deeper level, on the Krishna level of things, I was thinking, okay, you know, there's something I should also learn from this. There's something I should glean from this, even though it was this cowardly act. Let me learn from this. But I put a message out that whoever did write this, please come and talk to me directly. Ask me directly. When walking by a group of younger devotees, who I think probably fashion themselves as very strict followers, right? When I gave a presentation down in Alachua, Florida, when Dance of Divine Love came out, they were asking among the four of them, they were saying, who is this Garuda Das to write about the Ras Lila? And I then sort of backed up when I kind of overheard this. And I said, excuse me, I just heard your comment, and I think it's a very good question. I think it's a very good question. Why don't we discuss it? Would you mind, you know? And again, I think there's a fear of maybe discussing this in a straightforward way. But that's just the sort of thing that Vaishnavas want to do. So we're here to really exchange thoughts about what is the right thing to do. What should be written? What should be further elaborated upon for our tradition? So I think my watch is still set to East Coast time. Are we close to question and answers? A couple of minutes left. Okay. So in looking at all of these things, I've tried to give all of you of course, a sense of what Prabhupada himself is writing here and what Krishnadas Kaviraj himself is saying here. I mean, he says, fools. He addresses all of us readers as fools. You know, in a way, to put it in modern language, we might say, hey, stupid. Or you know, hey, dummy, or whatever. Fools, or, you know... we have a lot of words in English, right? Idiot, fool, imbecile, whatever. Okay, fools. Okay, just read Chaitanya Mangala. Okay? So in other words, he was inviting generously his reader to read other works that would be relevant to his own. By reading this book, you can understand all the glories of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, I mean, one could ask Krishnadas Kaviraj, so why are you writing this? Why did you write the rest of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is a huge work? So, in one sense, he's telling us, you know, stop reading this. Go read the Chaitanya Mangala. But we're not that foolish to not read the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Okay? So, Prabhupada gave us the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And he didn't give us the Chaitanya Mangala. Do you know why? Well, I can't speak for Prabhupada, but I can tell you why. I think why. Because the Chaitanya Charitamrita gives us an unexcelled presentation of Mahaprabhu's biography as well as the theology, a condensation of the Goswami theology that just can't be found anywhere else. So if you want to, you can go to the Shatsandarbha of Jiva Goswami. I don't think you'll find it, frankly, is nearly as interesting as the Chaitanya Charitamrita. I've read quite a bit of that in the past. I had to research it for my dissertation. But back then, it was kind of mechanical. Jiva would say one thing, and then he would say, just as it says here in the Bhagavad, then he would say another thing, and it was kind of a mechanical process. What Prabhupada has done here is he's brought it into such an attractive form, such an absorbable form. And this is wonderful. So when we read something like this, O fools, just read Chaitanya Mangala. We should, you know, I mean, on one hand, we could say, look, okay, let's stop reading chapter 8, Adi Leela. Forget about the rest of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Let's have Saturday and Sunday Chaitanya Mangala class. Here's the instruction. Or are we just going to be a contrary and just read on in any case and ignore what he said here? Well, we're not ignoring it. We're appreciating the spirit in which this was said. And the whole idea is, on the one hand, and I'll just end with this, on the one hand, we should be extremely cautious and not be cheap in our presentations of what we publish and so on. And I think we tend to be a little careless in the movement about what it is that we're going to publish, what it is that we're going to write. We don't get, I remember getting a book in the mail. A devotee wrote a book and said, Garuda, would you write an endorsement? And what do you think about what I've written? And I said, well, you've already published it. Why would I mean, the time to ask me what I think is when you're writing it. But again, that's, you know, it's somehow too much of this goes on. We write it and we just assume that someone's going to like it out there. So I couldn't actually endorse the book. So he went somewhere else and got someone else's endorsement. Fine. The time to review things is before you finish publishing it, you know. So on the one hand, we should be very, very cautious. On the other hand, we should also be like what the Bhakti Sutra says at the very end. Jana Jalpa Nirbhaya. Bhakti Acharya Jana Jalpa Nirbhaya. That the Bhakti Acharyas, the teachers of Bhakti, should they speak without fear of people's useless chatter. Isn't that a great statement? The Bhakti Acharyas speak without fear, right? Bhaya, jana jalpa, without people's useless chatter. So there can always, you know, so we have the opposite problem. Sometimes something very important can be published and people criticize it. And other times people publish things that are just like sort of a kind of rehashing what Prabhupada has already given us, you know, and then people think it's great. So, you know, there are these different issues that come before us. And this part of the Chaitanya Charitamrita really brings all of this up when Krishnadas Kaviraj is seeking authorization from the Vaishnavas and the deity for writing this great work. And boy, am I glad that they authorized it, because the Chaitanya Charitamrita is my favorite book. If someone were going to put me on a desert island, you know, or even not a desert island, like the English island, like forever, I would take with me, right, you are an island, aren't you? See, in the U.S., we're like a continent. Anyway, I'm sorry, I don't want to, like, you know. But in any case, I would take the Chaitanya Charitamrita. That would be the book I would take with me. If I could only choose one work, I would take the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Any comments, questions, refutations, corrections, disputations, anything from anyone?